Brian, how you doing? Are you all right?
That's about. How are you?
I'm good here. I'm going to turn up your microphone an awful lot further up.
There we go.
Good man yourself. 51552 is our text. The name Brian there has a surname. It's Lloyd, and he's in to talk to us here about something that I'm going to try and struggle with, but here it goes. Because I'll tell you what it is. Let's see if I've got this right. Most people, we watch a movie, we say whether we like it or not, and we leave it at that. But some people become so invested that they create their own theories about what's actually happening, and they describe intricate connections between different movies. And it's all stuff that isn't obvious necessarily to the naked eye or the naked brain, but when you hear the reasoning behind these theories, you might think, you know, you might be right, you have a point there. Is that what I'm, like, fan theories?
Fan theories, that's essentially what they call it. I mean, they've become more popular in recent years, you know, thanks to the internet, but there's something that have been around for years. Like The Shining, for example.
The Shining, yeah.
Yeah, The Shining by Stanley Kubrick. I mean, that has a ton of fan theories, and there was actually a documentary made out of it called Room 237.
Oh, what's the big fan theory?
The big fan theory about The Shining, anyway, is that it was about Native Americans, that it was all about the slaughter of Native Americans, and that, like, Stanley Kubrick had basically put all these little signifiers and little kind of, you know, nods to it in the background, and that people couldn't see, because Stanley Kubrick was one of these people that was really into subliminal advertising. He actually, like, really, before he did The Shining, he did a lot of research about it. It's all in this documentary. I really would recommend it. You're kind of looking at me like I have 10
No,
heads.
I'm just thinking, like, was there a bottle of Coke behind the little kid as he was going red rum?
No, but there actually is. No, here, I'll point out one scene for you, right, and this is actually true. The scene where he's in the cupboard with the Scatman Crothers, and he's explaining everything to it. Apparently you can see an Indian head standing right beside Scatman Crothers' head.
Wow.
And that apparently means that he is, yeah, see, look, it's a little bit incredulous, absolutely. I mean, it maybe is the kind of thing that you're just reading way too much into it, but there is a lot of evidence for these things.
Yeah, it's good fun to read a lot
of
these things.
Yeah,
especially if other people have theories as well, and you can swap them. Okay, you can certainly do that now online. So give me an example. What are we actually talking about? Give me one. Theories.
The first one I have is basically every Quentin Tarantino film is set up in the same universe. Now, in fairness to Quentin Tarantino, he's actually admitted that this is the case. If you look at his first films, as in like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, right? They all refer to various different films in their universe, if you know that sort of way. As in, like, there's a scene in Pulp Fiction when Uma Thurman is talking about this TV pilot that she went up for, and, you know, she basically describes the plot of Kill Bill. And there's loads more evidence as well. I mean, the actual character that Uma Thurman plays in Kill Bill, Beatrix Kiddo, there's a whole thing that she was buried in Big Kill Bill 2. She's buried in this, like, shallow grave, and it belongs to a woman called Paula Schultz. And then in Django Unchained, Christopher Waltz's character is called Dr. King Schultz. And, like, this just shows you the amount of detail put into it. People actually checked out that the time that the date on the grave of Beatrix Kiddo's grave is 1853, and Django Unchained was set in 1858. So the character is the same. I know you're looking at me like I'm 10 heads, but I mean, like if you go through it all in Quentin Tarantino's films, there are a lot of kind of like little nods to it. Like,
but hold on a second, like, I mean, like directors do this kind of stuff all the time.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So, like, it's not necessarily fan theories. It's just a fact. It's there, and
these
people are just pointing it out. And even if it's only them that uncovered it, as opposed to the director saying it in an interview, it's there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they absolutely acknowledge it.
Oh, like, so your theories aren't necessarily kind of plucked from the Twilight Zone.
Well, some are and some aren't. I mean, some definitely are completely plucked from the Twilight. I'll give you another one. Now, this one is pretty dark. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, was all about murdering children. Yeah, genuinely. And now, this is, you have to remember that Roald Dahl, who wrote these books, I mean, he was known for making really
dark
and acerbic and just really, really, you know, unnecessarily dark stories for children. And again, if you go back to, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, if you take a look at it, when he kills the fat kid, Augustus Gloop, and he gets sucked up into the tubes, and then when they move on to the next one, there's only a certain amount of seats left for the people there. So it was basically that it was premeditated, and then it goes on that, you know, when he's driving the cream car and there's only four seats again, it's prior knowledge. So it's, you know, now that I think is basically plucked from the sky. I think that was just a case of they just made these seats.
Wow.
But again, like,
wait a minute, is this like is everybody kind of dead? Is that what you're saying?
Like, no. It's in like that Willy Wonka was killing all the children.
Yeah.
He was basically killing off the children one by one. And if you look at the amount of seats that he had for their little rides, when he goes through the LSD thing and all that, there's only a certain amount of seats that he knew he was going to kill off one of the kids.
Right.
So,
I can't remember much about it, so you had me there. Go on. By the way, the types of people. Who are they? Every Tom, Dick and Harry comes up with these things just because they like the movies, they see them and they've maybe seen them a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Can invest that much interest and time.
Exactly, yeah. This is it. I mean, it's the sort of thing that's usually like super fans, as in people that, you know, have watched it so many times that have just completely invested their lives into it and they're just completely pulling it apart. Now, again, like I say, more often than not, it is super fans. It is people that are really, really invested in it. But then there are other people that just watch it and think, actually, hang on a sec, that looks like this and that looks like that. And then they just kind of start to pull the strings together. And again, this goes back to the whole thing about The Shining, is in that, you know, people were watching it and they were thinking, well, that looks a lot like that and that has a bit of reference to that and this has reference to that. And then they kind of analyse the director's careers and then they kind of extrapolate their theories from that.
Right, well then, just the bit of, like, you know, the cover of Abbey Road with the Beatles are walking across the road. It's that kind of person.
Exactly.
Because, like, for instance, one of them, I think Paul is wearing bare feet. And in Burundi, bare feet means death. So yeah. Paul is dead. And also, there's the Volkswagen to the left-hand side.
That's right.
The number's IF28. If Paul had lived, he would have been 28.
Exactly.
Proving that Paul is dead.
Yeah, that was it. And look, what was it? Ringo Starr was dressed like an Undertaker.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
John was like,
is that what
Jesus
we're talking about here then? Yeah.
Yeah,
because
that's
the thing about, I mean, like, here's one that's not even a theory as such. It's like so bloody obvious to me. And I've mentioned this to a few people and they go, what? You know the Magnificent Seven, which, by the way, there's a new Magnificent Seven coming up. Okay, the famous Magnificent Seven with Steve McQueen, Yul Brynner, and all the rest.
Of course, of course.
In fact, that's a great quiz question thing, isn't it? Name the Magnificent Seven. Anyway,
Charles Bronson.
Yeah, okay, all right, shut up. Hold on a second. So you go back then, and it's based on the Seven Samurai.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, but like, I mean, if you've seen A Bug's Life, it's the exact same story. People go, really? What? Like, they hire the gunslingers to kill the baddie. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, that's
okay,
it. Like,
that's an obvious one. So I'd be.
But there's other ones as well, like and I don't have it on my notes, but The Incredibles, they say, was actually basically Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged turned into a Pixar film.
Right, yeah.
You just mentioned A Bug's Life and a kid's thing.
Yeah. Okay, go on. By the way, A Bug's Life and all the Pixar stuff, is there a correlation between that and Tarantino?
There is. There's a thing that basically every Pixar, again, this kind of goes back to the Quentin Tarantino thing, that every Pixar film is connected, that they all are set up in the own same universe. Now, how they kind of justify this is that in the background you can see like a pizza planet in, I think it's Toy Story, and Pizza Planet was in was also mentioned in Finding Nemo. So it's the kind of thing that it's more in that case with Pixar, that's more in to do with the fact that the animators all work on the same film and they're just putting you know pre-used kind of things into it. So it's a little bit wishy-washy.
If I was a school teacher now, I'd say must try harder. Next.
Exactly.
Okay, give us the next.
Well, I'll go again, talking about Stanley Kubrick. 2001. You've seen that.
You didn't
like it. Now you said it was quite boring.
Well, I mean, I tell you, the opening scene of the music with the big thingamabob banging the bone against the monolith, fantastic. But once Hal and started kicking in, it was like, oh God, get on with it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Anyway, right. Well, here's the thing about 2001, because we were saying Stanley Kubrick, like, he's so known for infusing his films with like subtext and symbolism and so on. They basically say that 2001 was all about sex. So it starts off with, you know, the third act is just really, really personal. You have, like, do you remember the Discovery Craft, that thing?
Vaguely, yeah.
Vaguely. It looked like a penis.
Keir Dalia. Oh,
Keir
Dalia. Right.
That basically looked like a penis. And the scientists that were inside it were, in actual fact, sperm. And even, like, the sleeping chambers that they're in looks like sperm. Again, I know you're looking at me like,
I wasn't thinking that when I saw the movie. Go on.
But then when they're actually moving the Discovery Craft towards the monolith represents a woman's vagina.
You could say that about every second
actual Discovery goes into the monolith, there's the big massive, you know, the starfield thing and all the things are wiped or and it's all going crazy. That's the act of sex. The act of sex. And then we actually see Keir Dalia going through all the different phases of his life. That's the act of, you know, pregnancy and so on and so forth. And then when it comes to the end, it's the weird little, the embryo
the
thing and
the
star child, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, the third act is basically all about sex in 2001.
Okay, I believe you. Okay, go on, give us some more.
Another one. This one I think is actually does have a lot of evidence. James Bond was an assumed name and each James Bond died and retired to make way for the other one. Now if you start off with Look at Goldeneye, the first appearance of Judi Dench when she played M, And Pierce Brosnan's Bond, he just mentions that, oh, your predecessor kept drinking that cabinet. So that kind of refers to the fact that the person who played M before her, which was Bernard Lee, if I remember, that there is a sort of continuity that they take on these names and that different people assume the title of M. So it should correlate that different people assume the title of James Bond. And again, like, there's evidence for this. Like, if you look at on Her Majesty's Secret Service, that was the one with James or George Lazenby. Yeah. And at the end of that, spoiler alert, he marries Diana Rigg and then she's killed.
That's right.
So it's the sort of thing that...
By Kojak, if I remember rightly.
By Telly Savalas, yeah, that's right, yeah. And so what would you do after that? If your wife was killed, of course you'd retire. And that's why George Lazenby only did one Bond film. Now, of course, we all know the real reason for that was because he was a crap actor and that was that. But, I mean, there's other things as well. Like, as in Skyfall, for example, do you remember Albert Finney played the gatekeeper, or the caretaker of the house?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the original...
That was in the part three. Ridiculous thing up at the end, which was basically... there's one. That's Home Alone.
Yeah,
that's
Home Alone.
Part of that movie was entirely Home Alone.
Home Alone, yeah.
Ridiculous, and here's, carry on.
And here's a better one for you. Sam Mendes originally approached Sean Connery to play that role that Albert Finney played. He wanted Sean Connery to play the caretaker.
And all he did was place guns all over the house. He spent about half an hour doing that.
Half an hour, yeah. It was like a little montage and everything. It was kind of like the A-Team. But yeah,
until Javier Bardem comes up and blows the whole place up. Oh, I'll just give it away at the end.
Ah, you're grand. Just stay out for years. Yeah. But that was the kind of thing, anyway. They basically wanted Sean Connery to act as like the old James Bond and that Daniel Craig was the new James Bond, and this would kind of give him credence to the theory. I mean, like, directors of James Bond films have even come out and said, actually, yeah, that's a really good idea. I think it was for Die Another Day, it was director Lee Tamahori. He was at this Q&A thing and somebody put this theory to him. He said, yeah, that's actually a really good idea. Now, there's nothing official.
But like, Lee Tamahori should shut up, because Die Another Day was just
It was terrible.
Ridiculous. That's the one with the invisible car and the snow hotel.
Yeah, the snow hotel. And, it was crap. It was absolute crap.
Well, at least we agree on something. Okay, you're getting to me. Keep going.
Okay, right. Well, then another one is...
fan theories about movies, by the way.
Fan theories about movies and TV as well.
5-1, 5-2, or 10-1. Go on, yeah.
Okay, another one. This is a good one now, I think. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, John Hughes.
Yeah,
with Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
Basically, Ferris Bueller doesn't exist. Ferris Bueller was a figment of Cameron's imagination. That's the kind of nerdy kid that he brings out. Basically, the theory is that Cameron was this kind of really withdrawn person, and the entire day was set in his imagination, that he just created this, you know, ridiculous day that he drives around Chicago and goes to all these brilliant places, that it was all within his head. And the logic behind it is that you keep seeing, like, say, Ferris signs all over the city, which represent Cameron's desire to be cared for, and his father that he keeps referring to when he steals the car, he keeps referring to his dad as being this really controlling person that makes his life unhappy. So he creates these, like, outgoing, happy people in his mind.
So I've completely forgotten. I saw it when I came out, but that was 100 years ago. Ferris Bueller wasn't Matthew Broderick, was he?
Yeah, it was Matthew Broderick, yeah.
Okay, I'm slightly confused.
Do you remember like the
I
nerdy...
the car. Remember the car.
Yeah, I remember the car now. Do you remember like the nerdy guy that was with him? Who wore like the red hockey shirt.
I remember a school teacher giving out to him and a dog barking at the school teacher. That's about all I remember.
That's what I remember.
James Rebhorn.
That's not James Rebhorn.
No, is it not? Oh,
no.
Damn.
James, that wasn't James Rebhorn. No. That was, I forget his name, but it's not James Rebhorn.
Right, okay.
James Rebhorn was in like The Game and he was in loads of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I think he might have been in Homeland recently and died during
the
making
of Homeland.
That's
right, yes. Yeah, he was the dad.
He was
from
the
Homeland.
Mother of Carrie.
That's right.
Whoa, we're getting there now.
It's blowing my mind, Dave. Yeah, blowing my mind.
We're just as boring as these people who do all this. Okay, go on.
Another one, and this one was actually verified by the directors. Have you seen Aladdin, haven't you?
Aladdin?
Yeah.
As in the Disney mid-90s.
The Disney thing. Yeah. Now, do you remember at the start of it that there was this kind of like street peddler that was talking about a genie bottle? No.
Hold on. Is it Robin Williams comes out of the bottle, is it?
Yeah, Robin Williams comes out of the genie bottle, but there was this like street peddler that was trying to sell the genie bottle to the audience. It was kind of him breaking the fourth wall
at
the start of it. And he's telling this whole story about how this magical genie came to life, blah, 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 blah. And people actually realised that the peddler, the street peddler that was selling this genie bottle was actually voiced by Robin Williams, and that the peddler was the genie character. So that was basically the genie.
He was already out of the bottle.
He was already out of the bottle. And the director, again, this is the thing, the director actually said, yeah, we put that in intentionally.
Wow.
We expected people to see this. They didn't. They even actually had written an ending for it that would kind of circle back and show the peddler saying, yes, I actually am the genie.
Because nobody noticed.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Nobody
knows. I didn't know that.
There
okay.
you go.
Give us another one.
Another one. Okay, another one. Let
me
go.
I'm just being told here that Alan Ruck plays Cameron. Is Cameron?
Correct.
Alan Ruck. Never heard of him.
He was in Spin City. Remember that thing with Michael J. Fox? Yeah, he was in that. He was good.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, another one. The Harry Potter series was all a figment of Harry Potter's imagination. Now, again, this one is pretty dark.
I just admitted an hour ago that Harry Potter went straight over my head, so go on. Yeah,
okay, so basically, if you've seen Harry Potter, it all starts off with Harry Potter living under the stairs, and he's been kind of tormented by his...
That probably goes back to Psycho, where the mother was actually living.
You're kind of on the right track. But basically, what the theory is that Harry Potter was so kind of tormented by his oppressors that he was living under the stairs, that he was so unhappy that he created the entire universe all by himself, isn't he? Created this fantastical thing that he was
a wizard.
So
he's really under the stairs for the whole time.
Exactly.
And there was no Woghorts.
There was no Hogwarts and there was no end.
Hogwarts.
But basically that's the theory, that he was so kind of, you know, oppressed and friendless and alone that he basically just came up with this theory. Now look, I know, again, you're looking at me like I've got 10 heads. People believe this stuff. People actually, you know, put time and effort into this. Yeah, so there you go.
Fair enough. Okay, any more? I've seen movies like where the whole thing was a dream. Do you remember the Edward G. Robinson one? Was it The Lady in the Window or something?
Yeah.
And you think, oh my God, he's definitely going to die. He's going to be put in jail forever or whatever. And then suddenly he woke up and just realised that he'd been looking at a picture of a woman.
And then there was that one as well, that one with John Cusack, Identity. Remember
that? That's the name of the guy who played the principal Ed Rooney in Ferris Bueller. Geoffrey Jones. That's who I'm getting mixed up
and
with.
And he was in a lot of legal trouble. Yeah, that we will not go into.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, I'll give you another one. Where am I? Now, this is a good one. This is pretty funny. Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Jessica Fletcher.
Right.
Actually a serial killer.
Really? I must say, everywhere she goes, a murder happens.
Exactly. That's literally it. That is literally it. It's in a town like the town that it's set in, Cabot Cave or Cabo Cave or whatever it's called.
What? Is it set in a town? I don't know.
Yeah, isn't that the name of Cabot Cave?
I'm sure it is.
Anyway.
Wait a minute. Is she in the same town all the time as the murder every single day?
I think that's it. She goes around, but more or less it's all in that town. Yeah. So.
Jeez, if I saw her coming, I'd leave the cafe immediately.
This is it, yeah. So it's like, this is it. Like, it's a town that has 3,500 people. Yes, there have been 274 killings, and she has been directly involved in every single one of them.
Yeah, right.
Jessica Fletcher is a serial killer.
Bit suspicious.
Okay. Now, come on, 3,500 people.
Is she coming to the Dublin Film Festival?
She is, yeah.
Yeah,
Jessica Fletcher. Or Angela Lansbury. Sorry, God.
So don't go to the Dublin Film Festival.
There'll be a murder, God, but it'll be actually bad.
So go on, tell me, sorry, what, she's been involved in them all?
She's been basically being involved
with
them all.
She does it just so she can go through the kind of motions of solving.
She can go through the motions, yeah. Like, I mean, it's the sort of thing that, like, she was a serial killer and kind of parlayed these, you know, dozens of murders into her best-selling mystery novels, and the fact that she's a widow and she, you know, never reveals the nature of how her husband died. And then you have the whole thing, as I say, about the fact that there was 3,500 people in this town and there was 274 killings and she was involved in every single one of them. Now,
wow, because I mean, like, this is what people are writing, and they write it in such a way online that you could say,
when you say it out loud, she's a serial killer. Like, no, of course she's not, but it's the sort of thing that there's evidence to suggest, I suppose.
Evidence to suggest.
Yeah,
I love it. Okay, give us another one.
Okay, another one is about Peter Pan from the Disney thing. Now, this one, to be honest, I think this one might actually be...
That was the J.M. Barrie story.
The J.M. Barrie story,
there was nothing dark about the Disney version, if I remember right.
No, there wasn't anything particularly dark about the story or, you know, the Disney version. But the theory is that Peter Pan was the Grim Reaper and all the Lost Boys were dead. So how they kind of do this is that Captain Hook was terrified of clocks, and clocks symbolised the eventual ending of things. Peter Pan, you know, could fly around. He was forever youthful.
Go back on that for a second.
Yeah.
You need to have to say a sentence like, clocks symbolise the eventual endings of things.
But this is
in order to prove your theory.
No, there's more. There's more. Right. There's more.
That's so pathetic.
No, but like Peter Pan, he's this youthful kid that he's able to fly, that he's, you know, has this band of little boys with him and what have you. But, you know, the representations of the Grim Reaper is this, he's this cloaked figure with a skull, but there are other representations in art of the Grim Reaper as a child, that he's this, like, small child that takes people away. And the theory is that Neverland is actually heaven, the Lost Boys were actually dead, and that Wendy was, at the start of it, she was quite sick, and polio was quite common back then, and the theory is that Wendy actually died and went to heaven.
Well,
and Peter
Pan...
Well,
no kids listen to this now.
Really,
you're ruining their childhood. Okay, one last one before we go. Yeah.
Okay, one last one, and this one is about Lost. Now, Lost...
You know, I can't believe it. I'm so pleased you haven't got any Star Wars ones or something, because they would go right... Oh, you probably do,
yeah. Well, I have one, but I was going to leave it off, because I know... No, I'll leave it off, because I know you don't like Star Wars.
No, it just means you can make up anything about things like Star Wars and say it's this, that, and the other.
Well, this
and,
is more... Yeah.
Boris Spassky doing feckin', you know, kind of... some world championship of chess.
Yeah, I mean, there's all... Like, yeah, I mean, Star Wars, yeah, it is true. You can extrapolate any kind of things. But this one I have is about Lost. Now, Lost was really, really well known for just having tons of fan theories about it. I mean, that was kind of the premise of the entire TV series, that people could just read anything into it.
Yeah.
And that they could kind of get any sort of theory out of it. But basically, the theory of Lost is that the island was purgatory. And how they kind of do this is that, you know, basically that they all died, that the crash killed them, and that, you know, there was, the whole series was them trying to basically sort out their lives, and the whole thing, that it was set back in time then set forward in time, and, you know, it was all basically figments of their imaginations. And in fact, the final scene in Lost, again spoilers, is them going into this church and they all meet each other and they're all shaking hands, and this is them finally coming to terms with the fact that they're dead,
right,
and they can move on with their lives.
Yeah, I must say I kind of lost
I don't know. I watched the first three seasons. I gave up.
I went as far as the second one when your man went on about the rock band he was in, Driveshaft.
Right,
that's enough. I wouldn't want to listen to Driveshaft. And by the way, like you just said that the show was purgatory, you're damn right.
So Lost, it's just an interminable and never ending thing. Yeah,
nonsense. All right, listen, we need to get out of here. Brian Lloyd, you've convinced me. You're fantastic.
Thank you
very much indeed. With your fan theories, I'm going to come up with some and use an assumed name on the net. Okay, time to get out of here. So we will. Connor's taking over now. Lunchtime for Larry, and we will be